This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Monday, July 30th, 2018. I'm Caleb Brown. When the White House began threatening the security clearances of people who have publicly criticized the president, the goal was likely not to punish them so much as send a message to potential whistleblowers down the line. That from Cato scholar Patrick Eddington. We spoke last week. The president has many critics. Some of those critics have taken to the airwaves to talk about the problems they have with the president. John Brennan has described the president's performance in Helsinki as treasonous. And John Brennan, of course, is former head of the CIA. And in response, the White House has said, well, maybe we need to remove or revoke these critics to the extent that they have top secret or other security clearances. We need to revoke those clearances as a response. And they haven't really seemed to try to hide the fact that this is pure retribution for public statements made by people who have been in the intelligence community. So is there any case to be made for that being a reasonable thing?
Given the context, no. Now, I find myself in this really bizarre position, as I noted in the piece that I wrote for Just Security on the 24th of July of 2018, earlier this week, that I'm in the position here of having to defend people who I really, really intensely dislike from a public policy standpoint. And you've already talked about one, former CIA Director John Brennan. And for those who may not remember, it was Mr. Brennan who was the chief public apologist for George W. Bush's torture program. He did so in the NewsHour in 2005. And of course, it was also Brennan who ordered the break-in of computers being used by Senate Intelligence Committee staffers to write the report on the torture program. So I'm not a fan of Mr. Brennan's for that reason. Mr. Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, another one of the president's critics and targets, of course, lied under oath to the Senate Intelligence Committee about domestic surveillance of American citizens. And then finally, we have former NSA and CIA director Michael Hayden, who helped to engineer the domestic surveillance programs that have been targeted against American citizens, and also missed a prime opportunity to actually stop 9/11 by killing a particular program called Thin Thread, which I've written about elsewhere. So these are not individuals who I hold in terribly high esteem. That being said, like you and I, they are citizens of this country and they have a First Amendment protected right, particularly in the context of dealing with government, to say basically whatever they want to when it comes down to public policy issues. So these individuals, and of course, the other individuals that were named by Sarah Huckabee Sanders are kind of Trump's worst of the worst as far as he's concerned, former FBI Director James Comey, former FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, and former Obama National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. So, you know, one of the obvious questions that comes up in this context, of course, is, well, why in the world should these people continue to have clearances? And, you know, that's a reasonable question. And the answer really is actually pretty simple. Many times these folks don't actually really completely leave government. And what I mean by that is that there are literally dozens, maybe hundreds, essentially, of independent boards and commissions that reside within the executive branch on a permanent basis. An example would be the Defense Science Board at the Pentagon. And there are also, from time to time, congressionally created commissions, the 9/11 Commission, of course, being the most famous, most well-known, at least. So whenever individuals are named to those commissions, if they deal with national security issues, they are invariably going to get into material that will require them to have access to classified material. So to me, it's perfectly reasonable, let's say in the case of a James Clapper or any former director of national intelligence, I think it's reasonable ultimately for them to maintain that clearance at least for a year or two after their successor has been confirmed by the Senate, because the individual in question who's outgoing represents kind of the macro level institutional knowledge on the major issues that the intelligence community has been working. So I think that's reasonable. Where I get very squeamish about this is when folks like Mr. Hayden and I think others wind up setting up their own consulting firms or even go to work for major defense or intelligence community contractors, let's say like Booz Allen or Leidos, where having that clearance may give them, and thus their company, a potentially unfair competitive advantage in negotiating contracts, or at least in terms of having knowledge of what the government is potentially interested in. So I do have some real concerns there, and I think some kind of reform in that area is probably decades overdue, frankly. But what the president is doing here isn't just going after these individuals we've just discussed. His real target, in my judgment, are the men and women who are actually working in the Justice Department, and specifically the FBI and the attorneys, the agents and the attorneys who are working on Russia-related investigations. I think it's a clear attempt to intimidate them and to let them know that I can literally take away your meal ticket, which is your security clearance.
Right. So it's well understood that people who have security clearances, in fact, if you live in Washington, D.C., there are a bunch of websites that are job postings just for people with security clearances.
Yes, exactly.
And it is well understood that if you lose a security clearance and you work in that kind of environment, that your employment or your value as an employee goes down pretty tremendously if there are certain documents that are provided to contractors that you are not allowed to look at.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that probably with the exception of folks who work in, let's say, the information technology arena, where, you know, you can pretty much all, if you're decent at what you do, you can almost always find a job, you know, working IT, cybersecurity, things of that nature in the private sector. But for a lot of other government employees, and I'll just use my own background as kind of an example, if you're an imagery analyst, if you're somebody who was hired by the government to not just look at satellite imagery, but, you know, all this drone footage that we've accumulated over the course of the last 17 years in the so-called war on terror, that's still kind of a relatively discrete skill in a lot of respects. So if you lose your clearance in that context, you're absolutely in trouble. And of course, if you're if you're in law enforcement, if you're at the FBI, and you wind up getting your clearance yanked, then your ability to remain in federal law enforcement is pretty much gone. And the same would, of course, apply to pretty much any attorney working in the Department of Justice, but particularly those who work in the National Security Division. So it's this threat that Trump is making at Clapper and Comey et al. Isn't simply directed at them. I mean, those individuals, as I pointed out in my Just Security piece, they'll get by just fine. Right. I mean, they've had their book deals. They've got their network contributor gigs, et cetera, et cetera. They're not going to be hurting. It's the people at the GS-12 to GS-14 level in the federal government working at the Department of Justice and especially the FBI right now, but also in the intelligence community to a degree, that I actually worry about here in terms of potentially being at risk and the chilling effect. I think the very real and powerful chilling effect that this kind of thing could have.
On a related matter, the FISA court has released a substantially redacted, but less redacted than most of the time, warrant application, a FISA application that was filed by the Department of Justice for intercepts of communications between Russians and Carter Page, a one-time advisor to the Trump campaign. And a lot of Republicans in Congress, before the public saw any of this application, were making a big deal out of the fact that they were making use of not properly vetted information that had been circulating within the intelligence community and in the Department of Justice for some time. What do we know now that this application, still heavily redacted, what is it telling us about the way this information has flowed and the arguments that had been made by people in Congress about the quality of this warrant?
So on the first question, what we know is that contrary to the claims that have been made by House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes of California, the FBI was actually very blunt and very upfront in their initial application about the so-called Steele dossier, this, of course, being the essentially opposition research material that had been put together by former MI5 operative, British MI5 operative Christopher Steele and his firm. And in the document itself, You know, the Bureau is actually very clear about their relationship with Steele, and they are clear about their view that because his information was used successfully in other prosecutions, that he was, in fact, as far as the Bureau was concerned, a completely credible source. Now, you know, how much more of the dossier necessarily is going to turn out to be accurate or to be, you know, valuable, I'm not so sure that that's as much an issue now as the rest of the material that was essentially used to kind of target Page and the like. And as you indicated, this is 412 pages of material that the folks at Judicial Watch got through their lawsuit. And I'd say about 90% to 95% of this stuff is completely blacked out. So when we start talking about the other sources that were used here by the government, different kinds of electronic surveillance, possibly physical surveillance, possibly what are known as sneak and peek searches, things of that nature, anything that would have been done along those lines, as well as any additional information that would have been supplied by a foreign power, let's say like the UK itself, that's absolutely redacted in this document. So I think we can say that what we know so far is that what the FBI has been saying publicly is validated in a narrow sense by this document, which is that they did tell the court up front what their relationship was with Steele, as well as their assessment that on the basis of Steele previously providing credible information to the Bureau, which they actually used in prosecutions, that the concept that the president and Mr. Nunez have been pushing, that they lied, that the FBI lied to the FISA court, simply doesn't have any credibility, at least on the basis of these documents.
And there's a couple of things that people need to keep in mind with respect to FISA. It is a foreign intelligence court. And when they have information that they're going to allow the government to collect, it is not for the purposes specifically of investigating a crime that they believe has been committed. It is for the gathering of foreign intelligence that they think may lead to useful information for the intelligence community.
The primary, or at least what is supposed to be essentially the primary purpose of intelligence collection conducted pursuant to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is, in fact, to collect intelligence on foreign agents, like the 12 Russian intelligence officers that were recently indicted in absentia by Mr. Comey. That's the entire reason why FISA is supposed to exist. That is not to say that we should, you know, breathe some kind of sigh of relief and think that this process is necessarily pristine in any fashion. You know, my friends over at Demand Progress last year produced an extremely compelling document that talked about a number of the problems with the FISA court, to include false representations to the court by the Bureau, DOJ officials, and even NSA officials. So to me, one of the problems with any process that's secret is oftentimes the inability to actually really do a genuine audit on it and to really find out. And to the best of my knowledge, there's never actually been what I would call a relatively comprehensive audit of FISA, you know, an independent audit where someone goes in and takes a look at, you know, the applications that were supplied by the Bureau and then also looks at the totality of the information surrounding each and every one of those applications to see whether or not what they actually told the court, you know, was truthful in that circumstance. I would be willing to bet if an audit of that kind were conducted, we'd find out that there are, in fact, a lot more problems with FISA than what most people even imagine at this point. But we don't have a mechanism to do that. And to me, that's one of the great flaws in the system.
Right. As Julian Sanchez, our colleague, has pointed out, if you have problems with this particular application, then you have problems with FISA generally.
Yeah, I think that, you know, FISA, of course, came into existence after all the scandals, the intelligence, domestic spying scandals in the 1960s and 70s. And FISA was ultimately a product, if you will, of the investigation and deliberations and report of the Church Committee in 1976. And in my view, one of the problems fundamentally, you know, with the entire concept of FISA is secret law. You know, and Senator Ron Wyden, the Democrat of Oregon, member of the House or the Senate Intelligence Committee for a number of years now, has repeatedly, you know, pointed out that fact that we don't have the level of transparency that we need. And one of the attempts at trying to at least get at part of that problem was in the USA Freedom Act of 2015, which I have been and remain sharply critical of because I don't believe it's remotely a comprehensive solution to the problem. But one thing that they did try to do was actually ensure that there would actually be an adversarial process to FISA, which has never really been the case. So the court has the option. It does not have the requirement, but it has the option of essentially appointing what we would call defense counsel. In this case, we use the legal term amici to try to challenge and help review essentially the government's claims in a given FISA application. I think that ought to be mandatory in pretty much every case. I also think that we need to have either the Federal Judicial Conference or another body actually conduct the kind of audit that I've described here of FISA, the FISA process, FISA applications, and so on, to come up with a concrete way of really increasing transparency here and to just ask some fundamental questions about how much does the government really need, you know, to use this system. I have a lot more concerns about FISA, obviously, in a U.S. person context, right? I have fewer concerns about, you know, programs that we can say and activities that we can say with some degree of confidence really do legitimately target foreign intelligence sources. But I don't think that – I don't believe that the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is now effectively defunct and has been since Mr. Trump came into power, has ever had the resources, personnel or money, to do the kind of really in-depth auditing that needs to be done. And if there was any other body out there that we could potentially turn to do that, it would be it. But, you know, Trump hasn't appointed anybody to it. I'll be surprised if he appoints anybody to it for the balance of his presidency. Frankly, he doesn't just seem to have that much of an interest in it. So,
Patrick Eddington is a research fellow at the Cato Institute. Subscribe to and rate the Cato Daily Podcast at iTunes and Google Play, and follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.